Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
And for the first time in 2025, I am happy to say, welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy. He is Nick Osello, and we are here to talk about the inauguration of Donald Trump. Nick, thanks for joining.
You smell that in the air, Terry? It's positivity. It's optimism. And this is not related. This is not a political statement. This is me just being excited for the year.
This is me throwing you completely off what your expected intro was.
I was going to come in with positivity. And you're like, Nick, what do you think of the inauguration? And now I sound like a proponent for a certain political character. And if you know me, and if you've ever discussed politics with me, you know that I will inherently take the opposite position of whatever is sitting across from me. So just know that whatever you support, I am against, and whatever you are against, I support wholeheartedly. Been doing it my whole life between my liberal sisters and conservative father, and it's worked out pretty well so far. So,
how was your off season?
It was fantastic, Terry. As I may have alluded to last year, I am now firmly trying outdoorsman things. I am the worst fisherman. I am not a very good hiker. I can't hunt at all. And yet I find myself in these situations where I'm doing these things and just making an ass out of myself. And if you're just living in your comfort zone, you're not doing something right. And I'm glad I have the personality I do, because it's kind of funny to be the new guy in somebody's area of expertise and not getting frustrated and making it like funny and happy. So
when we last potted, you were embarking on becoming a fly fisherman. How do you describe your progress?
I went from a negative 2 out of 10 to a 1 out of 10.
Congrats.
But the first time I went, it was actually pretty funny, because I don't have like the front belly pouch. I just have like the backpack. So I'm getting the belly pouch this summer, but hooked a log in the river, had to go out and like, I bent over to pick my fly out of the log. Everything in the back of the backpack like fell forward. My waterproof fly case was open. And so there was like line, tepid, my fly, everything in my backpack just fell forward, and I was in like waist deep water. And so I had to like run and just in front of all these fishermen who know what they're doing. So I'm messing up their entire fishing hole to like half swim, half run and collect all the stuff that was floating down the river. Everybody was having a great laugh. And as I was like doing the walk of shame back up to the spot, they were like, I've never been happier that somebody just ruined my fishing spot. That was hilarious. Stick with it, brother. And I'm like, thanks, guys. How was your off season?
It was great. Watched way too much lacrosse, as is typically the case. Spent a lot of time watching The Stars of Tomorrow. So that was very fun. I feel like I've got my arms around the classes of 26, 2027, and maybe even a little bit of the 28s and 29s. But that is a story for another day. And aside from that, feel re-energized and ready to go. I got an opportunity to check out college lacrosse for the first time so far this spring. Yesterday, we were recording on Sunday morning, and I was able to attend Virginia and Marquette's scrimmages at Navy. So we will talk about those at the end of the pod. But to get things started, we're going to recap the off season, what you might have missed if you are the type of person that pays attention to lacrosse when you are otherwise supposed to, which is between February 1st and May 31st. And so, comparatively speaking, especially compared to the last 4 years, it was pretty light, you know, in terms of transfers and coaches and new programs and rules. And, you know, maybe at some point we'll talk a little bit about what's going on at a higher level within college athletics and the effect that that has had on lacrosse. But generally speaking, the only real rule changes that are enacted for 2025 are they're going back to the pre-COVID face-off mechanic. And that doesn't mean that the rules change. What it means is that the officials are going to basically have the face-off guys set up, put the ball down, and then walk away. And they're going to have two officials watching the face-off, which, if you listen to the face-off battalion, they are very much in favor of. As somebody who took face-offs collegiately and I'm sure never cheated once, how do you feel about this little tweak?
Overall good, and really the opinion that I've arrived at, given all the face-off discourse the last, I don't know, since the inception of the sport, but particularly in the last couple of years, I feel like every face-off guy, and I've talked to a couple both in college and the PLL, and they just say we work on mechanics, we work on everything, and we get our work in, but also we're kind of much more prepared for whatever is thrown at us from a rule change perspective. So I feel like the conglomerate opinion and the people who are going to be able to separate themselves have already established this mindset of, okay, this is what it is now, but let's just wait for the date when the rules committee throws something out, whether it's received positively or negatively. I feel like a change in face-off rules, whether it's downset whistle, whether it's not cheating, whether it's cheating more, whether it's clamp mechanics, everybody's ready to make an adjustment. Everybody knows that this was coming down the pipeline or something was coming down the pipeline. And I don't think that it's going to have too big of a material impact, as if there was another change for anything else in the game would have a much bigger impact. So honestly, I'm at the point, hey, whatever face-off happens, it's not going to change because face-off guys are so used to changing now. Is that fair?
They live in a state of constant vigilance. Well, I suppose when your entire existence is waiting for a whistle that always comes,
Yeah.
yeah, effectively it's a metaphor. It's extracting what they do and I don't know, proliferating it into their entire being. So yeah, I'm down with that analogy.
Well, and it's funny because the kid that I help in Boise, Crew Nelson, who's at High Point, it's me, him, and TD in a group chat, and that's where I get a lot of my face-off information. And from my perspective, which granted is mostly anecdotal from these two, but TD probably knows what he's doing, I like to think. It's just, hey, hammer home like three or four pillars and then just wait until you know what's going to be happening during the season. So, ban the face-off is really what I'm getting at.
The other kind of moderate change, and really the only other thing that kind of rose to the level of being included in a news story after the rules committee met, was around video review. And to be candid, like I don't even recall specifically what the changes were, which is only to suggest that they won't be that noticeable to the fans. So really, the only question that I have around video review is, with an entire season's worth of coaches' challenges and wider implementation than had ever previously been the case in lacrosse, what is your kind of current opinion of video review in college lacrosse?
It's net good. There are going to be some kinks that need to get worked out. The thing that has, I guess, surprised me the most is that the video review has not addressed targeting, at least that I've seen. And the reason is because that Kenny Brower hit on Pat or Chris Kavanaugh 2 years ago, in which, I mean, in the NFL, he's literally sent to prison. And yet in college lacrosse, it's a 2-minute non-releasable. I'm kind of becoming an old geezer in the sense that, like, there inside of us, there are two wolves: one that wants to see decapitations, ones that wants like to protect the minds of college lacrosse players. Surprised that it hasn't made its way into the targeting realm, and that's something that, shocker, as much as the high and late jokes I like to make, I think is necessary and will be clear. But expect another year of, oh, there's a video review. It's 50-50. Half the crowd is pissed, half the crowd is not. And some kinks to be worked out. I don't think it's going to materially change too much. And there's going to be one call that everybody's pissed off about. But, again, in my happy and thriving positivity look, I think it's a good asset for the referees to have. I don't expect it to go perfect, and I expect it to be essentially a continuation of what we've seen the last 2 years. What do you think?
I'll put my hand up and say that, I was opposed to a lot of the choices that they made about how and when it could be implemented because I felt like the threat of slowing the game down considerably was very high. And I'm actually glad that we had the Notre Dame Georgetown regular season game for purposes other than just it was the most listened to episode of this podcast, or at least the second or third most last year. But it was also the example that I was afraid of that showed that my fear was valid, but it was, but that was the outlier. That so you know, I don't remember exactly how many reviews there were, but I think that there were two that lasted like 3 or 4 minutes, and the officials were going into the tunnel to watch the replay, and it just was. It was exactly what I was afraid of. It was you know, not needlessly, but it was making the game too long for the value of getting quote unquote the call correct. But I think in general and in large part, that did not become the case. That was certainly far from the norm. And you know, ultimately, I think what the choices were made were meant to do was prevent Duke's step in the crease against Penn State from happening again. And it wasn't like immediately tested, but to the extent that, you know, we're thinking about the 2024 Final Four, we're not thinking about a very controversial call that went the wrong way. And so in that sense, it was successful. And I hope that, I do think that threat of extending the game needlessly is still there, but I don't think it's very prevalent. And I think that most of the changes that were made were meant to reduce that threat by like shortening the window where the officials were able to take over, extending, which by proxy extends the window when coaches are allowed to challenge, and as a result reduces the total number of potential reviews because they're still only able to challenge a certain number of times, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. Moving on, the biggest coaching change was John Torpy's move to Brown from High Point, but that also, as you suggested there with Crew, meant that there's a new man in High Point and John Crawley as well. And then a handful of other changes, including at a program that you're very familiar with, Mike Morgan, no longer the head coach of Merrimack, that going to Mike Schiamana, who comes from the D2 ranks, where he was at St. A's prior to that, and then a handful of other changes as well. So I think the biggest one is Torpy's move to Brown, and I expect that we're going to be talking about that in a little bit with our guests. So anything you've got from the realm of coaching changes before we move on to the next topic?
No, I mean, this is where I, generally speaking, am not a huge fan of speculation until, you know, 3 or 4 games into the season. I'm a huge, huge fan of Crowley. You know, from what I've heard, he's the type of guy that makes the juniors and seniors, the people that kind of come in and think that they have a legacy spot waiting for them, a little bit more nervous. And he's kind of a guy that juices up the freshmen and sophomores, where it's like, hey, if you show the work ethic, skills, and athletic attributes and the right position to contribute, you're going to contribute. So I kind of like the sense that coaching carousels kind of give opportunities to younger players that may not have gotten one because somebody thinks that they deserve a legacy spot. That's really the only feedback that I've gotten from High Point. And in general, I like that. You know, I think it's easy for some coaches to slip into, well, I've watched this guy for 4 years, he's a safe bet, versus, ooh, you know, this freshman is showing a little something. Erring on the side of either getting a 50-50 split in playing time or giving younger kids a chance so that we can, you know, more deeply evaluate a roster, I am much more in favor of. So it'll be good to see, you know, knowing a good chunk of the Merrimack players well, even though it ended, you know, Mike Morgan's reign in questionable circumstances. Don't think it can be understated how much of an impact he had on the Merrimack lacrosse program and the young men that went through that. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to Mike Morgan. I know that he has the support of, you know, years and years of alumni behind him. Situation was what it was. I don't disagree. So I'm curious how some of the legacy players at Merrimack are going to respond to, you know, a brand new culture. And I was kind of trying to compare it to if/when Coach Corrigan departs Notre Dame. And there's kind of this connection with alumni in particular of like, oh man, like you think if I'm talking to a player younger than me or talking to a player older than me, oh man, you remember when Coach Corrigan did XYZ? What was the day that he yelled at you the most? And there's kind of some cohesion around it. So, you know, if I'm stepping into a new program, I hope that he's engaging the alumni, making them feel, you know, seen and supported, and kind of rallying the troops behind the new steps being taken forward.
two new programs at the Division I level. One, Iona, a brand new program.
You didn't give any insight there. What's your thoughts on Crowley and Thorpe?
Oh, I mean, I think we'll talk about it as the season goes along. I'm with you in the sense that I want to reserve judgment for what their results on the field end up looking like. But I also think that, and you know, this is going to sound like a very me answer, the broadest theme for 2025 is turnover. And so the thing that follows that is question marks. And that's true for Brown, it's true for High Point, and it's true for, you know, pretty much every program except for a handful in Division I. And so as a result, like, you know, I don't know that we're necessarily evaluating High Point on the basis of, you know, comparing them to their 24 results, because even if the current staff or last year's staff was still there, the results are going to be way different because their personnel is going to be way different. So, you know, I think that it's just important to keep that in mind when it comes to some of these programs and how that looks. But as I started to say, two new programs in Division I, Iona, a brand new program under the leadership of Chad Sermon, and Mercyhurst elevating from Division II in its second year since the departure of Chris Ryan, who's now the head coach at Mount St. Mary. Nick, one of the topics that I am most excited to talk about is a topic that we talked about a bunch last year, which is Jordan Faison plays football. And he threw a TD in a national championship game loss to Ohio State just 6 days ago. What was your reaction to Notre Dame's run to the college football playoff title game?
Well, first off, you're wrong. He threw a two-point conversion.
I actually was very concerned that was going to be the case. And I was just like,
how about you do
that? I ran out of time to check it.
I know you don't know ball like I know ball, but what a great run. And there were two things that I took away from it. One, there are probably assumptions that the general listener makes about my fandom. And I think that those assumptions would be incorrect. When the team that I love the most, Notre Dame, loses in a national championship game, I let it ruin my day. I don't let it ruin my week. Because I still have like college friends who are still dissecting, justifying, crying, you know, taking a dump in their pants and, you know, sleeping underneath the bed or in the kitchen bathroom or the bathroom floor. So, unbelievable run. We now have a war chest. And what the people that are saying, oh, Notre Dame needs to join a conference, we just secured $20 million going to ourselves from that playoff run, as opposed to, oh, we need to split it with a bunch of, I don't want to say pud dicks, but like a bunch of lower tier programs that are just happen to be in our conference. Incredibly optimistic about the future. Tough to watch Morgan Freeman with my girlfriend or any straight woman for that fact. He's the hottest coach, both from a coaching
standpoint. You called him Morgan Freeman?
What's that?
You called him Morgan Freeman.
Did I call him Morgan Freeman?
Yeah.
Oh, Coach Freeman.
I was Marcus watching Freeman. It's pretty much the only compliment you could probably give Marcus Freeman is to compare him to the guy with the sexiest voice of all time.
I was watching Shawshank Redemption last
night. Or March of the Penguins.
two of his greatest films, March of the Penguins and Shawshank Redemption. And quick story time on why I'm this way, because when we lost the national championship to Duke, I didn't have a great game, and there was an anonymous Twitter account that was DMing me, and he's like, yo, you just blew the game, you should kill yourself, Steve and Linnea are disappointed in you. Like, they looked up my parents' names. And I'm like, well, that's not exactly what I would call constructive criticism. That's really mean. So I've always erred on the side of like, good job, boys. Bring it home next year. Notre Dame has a war chest. More college football teams should be independent if you can justify it. What were your thoughts? Were you just sitting there wondering if I was freaking out?
No, I had a great that was part of my time. My dad went to Ohio State. So my grandfather and my grandfather went to Notre Dame, my grandmother went to Ohio State, my dad went to Ohio State, and now my nephew is a freshman at Ohio State. So growing up, I was a Notre Dame football fan until I was about, like, I don't know, 10 or 15, and then just kind of pivoted to Ohio State during the Eddie George era because he was my favorite player, and then was still up for grabs because I had high school teammates that played at both. But ultimately, like, my closest friend ended up playing at Ohio State, and that was what solidified it. So it was one of those situations where, like, you know, while I was cheering for Ohio State, I certainly was very excited to be playing Notre Dame, and you know, happy for Notre Dame fans to see the program find success, especially given that it was led by a coach who went to Ohio State.
That and just the fact that we made it a game later in the way that our offensive line played, like Ohio State had to play a damn good game. Going into it, I was like, okay, we need like two mistakes. We need like a fumble and an interception. And he started out going, I don't know, 15 for 16. And I'm like, if that's a game that they have to play to beat us, it's not, you know, the same as, oh, well, we just got out-athleted, out wide receivered, out running backed, out, you know, in the trenches. So I was, totally. I was generally happy with the performance.
Speaking of championships, the 2025 championship weekend is set for Foxborough. It is another joint event with the women's championship, which I believe was held for the first time in 2016, but it might have been 2017. The men's quarters are at Hofstra and Navy. One of the big news items that we hope to get clarification on over the course of this season is where the 2026 championship will be, because that was originally awarded to Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia. But both Gillette Stadium and Lincoln Financial are hosting World Cup 2026 games. So neither is available to host the men's championship weekend. The women's championship weekend has already been awarded to Northwestern. That came out, I think, about 10 days ago, and I think that's an awesome selection. They will still have the stands that they've erected on their women's lacrosse stadium for the football team in that window of time as they construct a new football stadium. And honestly, if the men's championship were held at Northwestern, I wouldn't be upset about it, because I think that would be a pretty incredible weekend for everybody that was able to be in attendance. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think it probably already would have been announced. I think that would have been a joint announcement. So we wait and see where we'll play a championship, not this year, but next.
Foxborough, cool, but, you know, from a fan perspective, or, you know, somebody who's trying to go there, the fact that it's 30 minutes away from Boston, not a huge fan of just having to commute from the major city that you're playing in to go to the field location. That's why I love the link. You know, get done watching the game and you're 20, you know, 15 minutes from wherever, whatever city you're in. Not a huge fan of Foxborough in general, but the stadium speaks for itself and it's going to be an awesome experience. I'm with you. I really wanted to see when the women's was announced at Northwestern, bravo, round of applause, standing ovation. And honestly, like in the way that the PLL was trying to capture, you know, that touring model, I think that should they take a chance and host a championship game from the men's side somewhere not on the East Coast, I think it would be received remarkably well. And I want them to take that chance at some point in my life. So Foxborough, 7 out of 10. The Link, 9 out of 10. You know, throw it in Denver or Chicago, 10 out of 10. Projection.
Let's start talking about the 2025 season. The preseason media poll came out last Tuesday. Notre Dame, once again, number one, the two-time defending national champions. Syracuse checks in at number two. Cornell, 3. Princeton, 4. Maryland, 5. Virginia, 6. Duke, 7. Hopkins, 8. Yale, 9. Denver, 10. What are your reactions?
Not too many surprises here. I was kind of curious how they put together returners. They kind of seem to put a premium over returning cohesion as opposed to next step in level talent. So like totally. Seeing Duke at 7, yes, of course they departed, you know, some key players, but they're a stacked roster. Like seeing Syracuse at number 2, yeah, they're returning some guys that we've had the narrative for 3 years. Oh, when these guys get to their junior senior level, that's going to be unbelievable. I didn't see anything too surprising. Princeton at 4 was a little surprising to me. But other than that, it's Notre Dame's to lose. And I would have put a bigger premium on guys who have shown promise in the, whether you call them scrub minutes, whether you call them second line guys. The depth of rosters can't be understated enough, because as we've seen from Syracuse, you know, a couple of their top players get shut out. They couldn't find ways to win beyond that. So that was my initial reaction. What was yours?
This poll reflects my value structure, is the way that I would put it. And I think you're kind of setting up what is the opposite point of view, which is, yeah, you kind of have to make a choice between valuing continuity and versus valuing assumed talent, right, and track record. And I think that by having so the way I see it is that Notre Dame and Syracuse are clear number one and clear number two, right? And then I think that there's a tier break, and it could be sliced up whichever way you wanted it to be. And you know, if you're betting on talent, then it's justifiable to say Maryland, Virginia, Duke, 3, 4, 5. And if you say, you know, Cornell didn't make the NCAA tournament last year, Princeton didn't win a tournament game, so how can they be 3 and 4? It's I can hear that argument that, you know, is it makes sense. So I think that Yale being at 9 is a little bit of a deviation from that overall idea, and so that is a little bit of a question mark or a head scratcher. I talked to a coach for a team that was in this top 10 earlier this week, and he thinks that Cornell and Yale are the third and fourth best teams. And this is a guy that's been right a lot more often than he's been wrong when we've spoken about it. And then I will say Denver at 10 is, it strikes me as a hedge in the sense that, you know, Denver and Hopkins, in my opinion, graduated more numbers-wise in terms of volume of players, volume of contributors than anybody else. I think Denver essentially either graduated or lost 12, and Hopkins graduated or lost 13. And so I think that's the reason that they're at 8. You know, Hopkins is at 8. They lost in the quarterfinals. They were one of the closest games in terms of quarterfinal losers. So, you know, theoretically, that would justify them being a little higher. Denver obviously made it to the Final Four. So, you know, maybe that would justify them being a little higher. But at the same time, like, you know, there are a ton of questions. And I think that one of the other questions that you have to ask is, you know, the specialty positions, faceoff and goaltending. Like, how much more emphasis are you going to put on teams that have to replace those versus teams that have those back? And I think that when you look at Syracuse, that's a real kind of question because that is, I mean, they basically return pretty much everything other than their faceoff guy, one of their top three middies in Stevens, and then their LSM and Sam Alexo and their goaltender. And so, you know, really looking at a faceoff guy and a goaltender as question marks for the Orange, kind of with the expectation that maybe Sam English can step into that role. And then certainly they've got depth at long pole as well. You know, that's where, all right, I feel like Syracuse can fill in, but you know, they have Johnny Mullen at the faceoff X. He's pretty well known. And then they've got what sounds to be Jimmy McCool, who hasn't played a ton of college lacrosse, but was really a highly recruited player coming out. So I think that's the justification for Syracuse at number two. But you're right. Number one, Notre Dame. And what is your outlook on the Irish, given no Pat Kavanaugh, no Liam Entenmann, but still an incredibly deep stable of midfielders? Got to replace two close defensemen in Chris Conlon and Marco Napolitano, but bring back a bona fide Schmeisser Award contender in Sean Light. And then our boy Will Lynch, who I will always associate with my consoling you after a couple of rough performances his freshman season by saying he'll get better. And he has done absolutely that and is certainly a bona fide contender for a Teamer All-American.
It's tough to talk my way out of thinking they're going to three-peat at this point. Biggest question mark is replacing Liam Entenmann. I mean, watching him on the screen versus watching him in person, like, it cannot be understated the effect that he would have, particularly on outside shooters. I mean, I reflect on that Maryland game, and I think Maryland shooters got two out of their first three mid to long range shots in, and they were like, perfect, this is what we're doing. But watching Entenmann's reaction after those two shots, he was like, guys, that's on me. Like, keep giving those shots up. So it was wild watching the defense be able to pack it in. And there was even an analysis done. I can't believe I've been trying to think of his name. The Maryland stud who's doing lacrosse breakdown. Help me out here, Terry.
The Cornell transfer?
No, graduated from Maryland in the NLL. He's doing
Yeah.
his.
Jonathan Donville.
So,
He started at
John,
Cornell,
I
and
am
that's
sorry. I
yeah.
am sorry that I was just trying to remember your name for 30 seconds, but he did a great analysis. Go and watch it on the difference between Denver and Notre Dame's defense and Notre Dame's ability to kind of press out and stretch, and Denver's, packing it in. And a big reason for that is like the athleticism of Notre Dame's defensemen versus, hey, if we give up a skip pass up top, that's fine. Sean Light, we'll see what he's able to do. I mean, lock off and watch him go to work. I think he should be a Tewharton finalist this year. And his freshman year was something that I haven't really seen out of a defenseman in quite some time. For Notre Dame, it was Matt Landis who was like, "Oh, we have him for 4 years. Yeah, let's really take advantage of this." So, between faceoffs, between the returners, between Chris Kavanaugh having 7 assists against Air Force, between Jake Taylor returning, I don't see a way. It's ours to lose. And credit to Coach Corrigan and talking to some of the current and recent graduates versus me versus some of the older timers. I think he's found the better system of, hey, it's not a football play where we're running X's and O's. It's systems that we'll be able to play, and we're going to really develop the ability to play lacrosse and give whatever the defense is taking at us, and not going, oh, this play is going to result in a step down from right here. It's just this play is messing up the defense. Something will be open. Have the ability to execute whatever is open in that time. And I think that switch has been the reason why it's been the last two championships, and I continue to expect that coming down the line.
Well, since you are making predictions, let's continue with that. We'll quickly review last year's predictions, which is going to be a little bit of a victory lap for you. You picked your dark horse as Delaware. You picked Brennan O'Neill to go back to back from a Tewharton winning standpoint. Your final four was Notre Dame, Duke, Virginia, and Maryland. Very exciting. And you picked Notre Dame as the champion. My dark horse pick was Utah. I picked CJ Hurst to win the
I thought it was
Tewharton.
Lehigh.
No. Yeah, I got that wrong in the rundown. That's my pick for this year. So, spoiler
Yeah,
alert.
okay.
My pick was CJ Kearse. My final four was Duke, Maryland, Hopkins, and Syracuse, and my champion was Duke. So, you went 3 for 4 on the final four. I went 1 for 4, but three of the teams that missed all lost in the quarterfinals. So, I'll take that as a little bit of a consolation. And then I'm pleased with with Utah as a dark horse pick. I suppose it's not really that valid given that, they had won the ASUN the year before and they did the exact same thing. So I guess they would have needed to have won a tournament game in order to validate that. The one thing I wanted to revisit from that, though, is that you said you proclaimed that Delaware was going to be America's team. And that was a bold enough prediction only insofar as NJIT became America's team out of nowhere. Otherwise, I would say you did okay. I want to know whether Brian Kavanaugh has chirped you for not picking Pat to win the Tewharton, which he ultimately did.
I couldn't escape that conversation in the parking lot of the link. And again, we will regale it because he was like, "Yo, tell Terry Soy was their nickname for you," which I will never not laugh at. Like, "Yo, tell Terry Soy to stop disrespecting, Pat Cav." And I'm like, I feel like he is a pretty big fan. And they're like, "No, he didn't choose him to win the Tewharton and, to be Captain America and just, win World War II for America." And I'm like, "Okay, but you got to understand, we're talking about a lot of different players." He's like, "Yeah." So you can talk about a lot with the Kavanaughs. Their number one trait is hyper self-belief in their brothers. And I feel like that just fuels them to heights that I had never seen in my entire life. Like, I was like, yeah, I chose Pat as like the number two behind Brennan O'Neill. And the amount of expletives that was thrown in my face in the parking lot of the link was, you would have thought that I like
You would have thought
tried
you
to
ran into
kick
an
out
Eagles
his
fan?
knees. What's that?
You would have thought you ran into an Eagles fan?
I would have thought something of that nature. So yeah, and I want to say I'm not gonna let that affect my Tewharton prediction this year. But my goodness, avoid the Kavanaughs if you don't pick them to be the number one of everything, which is
Right.
great.
So you teed it up nicely. My dark horse pick for this year is Lehigh. I saw him in the fall against Maryland mostly. They scrimmaged Maryland and Penn State. I was mostly watching the Lehigh Maryland game and came away really impressed, especially when you consider how many starters didn't participate in that contest. They would qualify as a dark horse because Army is, a preseason top 20 team. I think they're 11th, and that would justifiably make them in the favorite in the Patriot League. So if Lehigh can win, then that would qualify as a dark horse in my opinion. My final four, I'm going with Notre Dame, Syracuse, Cornell, and Yale. My champion is Notre Dame, and my pick for Tworton is Pat Kavanaugh, even though he's not playing. He graduated, but I'm going to pick him in order to avoid the wrath of the Kavanaughs.
That's a great pick. So for mine, my dark horse is going to be Harvard, actually. I think Sam Hinkie is going to have
Ooh,
an
loyalty.
unbelievable year. I think he's going to be a Tworton finalist. I don't think he's going to win it, but I think that this is going to be a year the same way that we've been talking about Syracuse. I'm going to apply that roughly to Harvard with they have a little bit of continuity. They have some fantastic playmakers on offense. Still a couple question marks around them, but I think this is the year that they kind of crack the code, make a bit of a run in the playoffs. And you know what? Yeah, there is some Coach Byrne influence there. But with that being said, I think they had some incredibly bright spots last year. And the more that I watched them, the more I was like, there were only like a couple 3 minute spurs every game where they just seemed to dig themselves in a hole that they couldn't get out of. I think that changes. I think things are tightened up. So not only are they my dark horse, but as we look at the final four, Notre Dame, Duke, Maryland, Harvard sneaks in there.
Wow,
So,
bold.
well, and I was looking at my picks last year and I'm like, God, that's boring. I got to mix it up a little bit. So that's my mix up. We'll see if it goes terribly wrong, or we'll see if I look like a genius, heading into May. For the Tewarton, CJ Kirst, I want the smoke with the Kavanaughs. I think Chris is an unbelievable player, but swing at me. I spent 9 years of my career defending Matt. Is that not good enough for you? So I'm gonna go with CJ. I think you would have too if you wanted to avoid the wrath. The way that his game is complete, and let's not forget, he took Notre Dame down to the wire. He is an unbelievable player. Struggle to find things that he can't do. Especially, he gets a full head of steam. He can stop on a dime. He can finish inside. He's a threat outside. Complete player. I think Cornell's gonna go on a run. If I wasn't being ACC biased, I should probably throw them in my final four. My champion, shocker, Notre Dame three-peats, and Kevin Corrigan solidifies himself as, whoa, this is one of the best dynasties we've seen ever. People forget about 2022 Maryland. People forget about 2014 Duke. Everybody forgets everything about the struggles of Notre Dame in the past, particularly from 2011 to 2015, which is when I played for the viewers. And Notre Dame just has the train rolling, so.
All right, Nick. As I mentioned, I was at Navy on Saturday in order to watch Virginia, Navy, and Marquette. So it was three scrimmage games. It started with Navy versus Marquette, which I was not able to get there for. What I was told is Marquette came out kind of blazing against the mids. I think built up a 4-3 first quarter lead, and after that, Navy subbed liberally for the remaining three quarters, and Marquette finished with a 16-12 win over the midshipmen. The second game, which I arrived just at the start of, was Virginia 2s against Marquette's starters, but they were obviously coming off of having just played a game prior to that. Virginia jumped out to an 8-1 first half lead, and I think finished 14-7 victors over Marquette. I came away from that really impressed by Marquette goalie Lucas Lawless, who was the starter against Navy as well. I thought he was a bright spot. Beyond that, a lot of question marks, I think, for the Golden Eagles. It starts at the faceoff X. Obviously, they were going against one of the better returning faceoff specialists in Navy, Zach Hayashi, in the first game. And then Anthony Gobriel, who had surgery at the end of last season, played against Marquette, where it was Notre Dame transfer Andrew Greenspan and a couple other faceoff guys for Virginia going against Hayashi in the last game of the day, which ended up not turning out well for the Cavaliers. But you know, aside from that, Bobby O'Grady is the leader on the offense, and you can kind of get that sense watching them. I didn't feel like there was a defensive presence at the level of a Mason Woodward that they had down low. And so, you know, in Jake Richards' first year, gonna kind of chart Marquette's progress by how they develop as the season goes along. For Navy, you know, I think that evaluating them against Virginia in the last game, which was Virginia's ones against Navy, coming off of having a game block about 2.5, 3 hours to recover, was a good evaluation. Where for Virginia, their ones, it was basically the first that they had played. You know, I think it was 8-4. Well, Virginia again jumped out to an 8-1 lead or 7-1 lead with about 4 minutes to go in the first half, and then Navy closed the gap to 8-4 at halftime, and that one ended up finishing up 14-8. There was a moment in either late or early fourth, late third, early fourth quarter, when Navy had an opportunity to what would have cut the game to a 2-goal game. At which point, you know, had it been a 4-goal game, that would have effectively gotten things a little tighter. But McCabe Millen with a backdoor cut, and that was kind of the biggest takeaway of the day, was McCabe Millen is fully equipped to take over the role that Connor Schellenberger has filled for Virginia for the last 4 seasons. And there's an interesting tactical relationship between Virginia wanting to play fast and really unlocking what Millen's best skills are. And there's something about playing fast that I think we're going to have to really focus on when it comes to Virginia this season. And it's the difference between scoring in transition, and particularly scoring with either long stick Mitty Ben Ware or Joey Terenzi, who is a two-way midfielder that played a lot of short stick last year and was the team's eighth leading scorer, seventh leading scorer. Ware and Terenzi were seventh and eighth. And then freshman Hudson Hausman, who's a top 10 recruit and is going to be reprising a similar role to Terenzi's this season. Terenzi didn't play against Navy, and I felt like they were really committed, even still, to pushing the tempo, but they didn't actually take a lot of shots in that first 5 to 10 seconds after the ball crosses the bin line. Instead, what they did was they were really effective in the second phase, that sub game after the attackmen have touched the ball, and now you're into your second, third, fourth, fifth pass of the possession. And Millen scored twice on shots from the point off of fast breaks, and then he scored twice in that early offensive zone. One, both down the same alley. One, I guess you would call it, if you're the goalie, you would call it the righty alley. If you're the offense, you would call it the lefty alley. And he scored once lefty on the run, once righty on the run. And then his play that I appreciated the most was carrying righty from the lefty wing through X, and he threw back over his left shoulder to Truett Sunderland, who is the number three ranked recruit in the class of 22. Played a lot as a freshman, but didn't produce that much, and then missed the end of last season due to injury, and Sunderland hammered a step down. He also scored two other goals, both on the doorstep. One, a crease finish when Griffin Schutz drew a slide and Navy's defense was sucked upfield, and the other, a crease finish on extra man. So after the game, Lars compared Sunderland to Ian Laviano, who was instrumental to Virginia's championship game performances. And beyond that, I think the concern for Virginia offensively is going to be how the rest of their top nine shake out, and if they have enough depth in order to be able to, you know, really get production out of their second midfield, or if effectively their second midfield is going to be that transition unit. Schutz, Sunderland, Millen played well. The rest of the offense didn't produce much in settled sets when I was watching. So,
And that's not only a fantastic breakdown, but that's what I get most excited about heading into a year is what is the recipe that's going to win? Is it run and gun? Is it slow it down and play methodical? What's the right balance of both? Which teams have the stable on a goalie save to go and push and make the right decisions? And then that trickles down from, oh, this coach clearly put an emphasis on that was probably a really tough preseason because these second and third line middies are sprinting up the field and making correct decisions. That's where my mind always goes, is I'm like, God, there was probably some really tough days in January with a lot of puke on the sidelines. But, you know, we can sit here and talk all day, Terry, but we have an expert. Many call him the Rain Man of lacrosse because the way that his mind works is just absolutely beautiful. And that's a compliment, by the way. Larkin, what gets you fired up? Welcome, Larkin Kemp, former Brown State legend, former Outlaws legend. What gets you most fired up about the 2025 season in general, not just specific to Brown State?
Great question. Morning, boys. Happy Sunday.
How's it going, Larkin?
And for everybody who thinks lacrosse is soft, we're recording this pretty damn early on a Sunday, so let's go to work here. What gets me the most fired up? I think just talent at the top. I think we've seen an explosion in ball carrying depth, and I'm really, really hoping that somebody can disrupt the establishment. I want Notre Dame to go down. I want someone to come hunting.
Everybody wants Notre Dame to go down.
So I think what excites me is the concept of new blood. Will it occur? Who knows? But I'm just, this is my favorite time of year. Everybody's 0-0 and there's a lot of teams dreaming. So if you're in this business, you're fired up.
Okay, now I just have a quick follow-up question. Sorry, Terry, to cut you off. Larkin, are you glad we played when we did? Because some of the stuff that I watch every year, I'm like, I would have been lucky to be warming up the bench because the level of skill, especially at the top, like the ones from even 2014 to 2024. My jaw is on the floor every single time I watch these kids run out.
Totally. Yeah, I think the skill development, you know, I'm blessed, I guess, to be able to live close to Brunswick, which is really elevated as a high school. And every time I go watch them play, like Lawrenceville or Hill or Culver, I'm like, holy smokes, boys. This is a different world, which is the best compliment you can pay the sport. And I think ultimately, hopefully, while you know, it'll lead to a good professional product and growth of the game. So the answer to that is yes. I don't think my, you know, get beaten trail would play in this era.
But your breakout upfield, I had you pegged for questions about Brown and Mike Daly in Maryland, so we'll get to those in a second. Yep. But it didn't occur to me that I went to Navy or Virginia scrimmage at Navy yesterday. Marquette was there as well, and one of my top two takeaways, two of the four, I suppose, were McKay Millen is really good. Yep. To your point about new blood and ball carriers, and then the second is Virginia is going to be committed to this early offense, and it's not just about scoring in transition, but it's also the second phase of early offense when they're trying to win sub games. And I guess the other big takeaway is beyond Millen, Truett Sunderland, who played the best I've ever seen him play yesterday, and Griffin Schutz, who, you know, a former number one recruit who I think in most fans' estimation hasn't necessarily reached those heights. Those three guys, I felt like, all right, that's Virginia knows they've got them. But beyond them, there are a lot of question marks. And it's possible that instead of having to develop or really rely on middies, well, offensive players 7, 8, 9, middies 4, 5, 6, what they end up doing is relying on Ben Ware, whose role you are very familiar with, as well as Joey Terenzi and a former Brunswick Bruin that you just shouted out in Hudson Hossman, who was another top 10 recruit. What is the expectation? How would you characterize how feasible that is in terms of building an offense around based on your experience playing for Lars and that ascendant program from 2013 to culminate in a Final Four appearance in 2016?
I think it's highly feasible. I think that Lars has had an embarrassment of riches since he's been in Charlottesville. And the reality is he's actually his brilliance, if you will, why he's a college lacrosse coach and a great one, came from a place of desperation. Like, he couldn't recruit at Stony Brook and at Brown to the top of the table, if you think of it as an index of, like, the league he was in. So, you know, early offense comes from a place of 6v6, we can't score against, you know, Yale as an example in 2012. Okay, how do we create offense? We come up with a notion of let's play 4v4. Let's not let them get settled. Let's put Dunn in space, whatever it is. So, I think for UVA, I think when you consider their size and speed, playing 4v4, 5v5, not allowing Notre Dame to get into their set base and forcing adjacent help to come from farther away to a guy like Schutz makes a ton of sense. So I think what you'll see is And, you know, Kip and Lars have done this forever, but I think you'll see more consistency in, with it. I think you'll see structure around the pace at which the poles break out to try and trap offensive midfielders on. So Ware is going to get very deep, very quick to prevent sub game. And then what they'll basically do is extended razor. And they'll do that with consistency, let Millen play off it. And what you have to hope, if you're them, is that, you know, a midfielder we've never heard of becomes a first-team All-American. And I think, candidly, with the athletes you referenced, that's fairly likely. Like, you know, talk about Houseman. I put a lot of time in recruiting that kid, so that's a bummer. But, you know, they got guys who can go both ways who play D-mid there, so they're going to be totally fine. I'm not too worried about it.
You know, Larkin, brilliant analysis. And this one, I'd say it's lacrosse adjacent, but with China releasing DeepSeek's R1 on, you know, just kind of the open platform at 98% more efficient than anything that we've seen from OpenAI, do you think that this is kind of the tech bro, tech nerds run of dominance over America? Do you think it's going to revert back more into kind of the jocks? Do you think that this is going to increase the pipeline of lacrosse players into more prominent positions and kind of have that power shift away from Silicon Valley, where the nerds, and it's like, I read a great headline of, I always knew that it was going to be some really, you know, really interesting people that would tank America. I just didn't think they'd be such losers like, you know, Zuckerberg, Musk, and things like that. Do you think that shift from Silicon Valley back to the jocks potentially speaks volumes to, you know, the pipeline of lacrosse to Wall Street? What do you think?
Loaded question. Holy hell.
Hey, it's early on a Sunday. What better
time? Early on a Sunday. I think it's going to be an interesting day on the markets on Monday, no question. I don't think people realize the composition of the Mag 7 and how much that makes up our aggregate e-commerce growth. If China actually plays ball on AI, that's not good. Especially if the return on invested capital is what they're suggesting. Do I think that there's probably some lies in an inappropriate term? But, you know, I'm willing to throw the challenge back for now on whether they can actually do what they're claiming. But, yeah. Yeah.
Well, Terry started this off by asking me what I thought about the inauguration. So I figured, in keeping that, I'll just throw one to you. And then, Terry, get us back to lacrosse here. That was my wild card.
Larkin, you are wearing a Brown State sweatshirt. Your loyalty is well known. The Bears have a new head coach in John Torpy, who is one of my all-time favorites. Give us your preseason prognostication. This is why everybody came to this episode of the Tailgate Podcast. Tell us what we don't know about Brown.
Yeah, I'm really excited for John. Everybody knows where I stand on Dales. He's a dear friend of mine. He's someone who's going to be at my wedding. He's a part of my family in many ways. You know, I owe him a lot. But the reality is, as you guys know, I bleed Brown. And, you know, I view coaching changes in many respects similar to like a hockey change, right? You know, whether it's Chief Berube or whoever, Gerard Gallant, like great coaches get fired. Great coaches come in to replace them. Ultimately, it's more about the kids in the room and the program. Like, it's bigger than the desk. And the things I really like about Torp, he comes from a place where he had to gimmick. He had to get creative to scheme, which is what we need. Ultimately, Brown, the number one thing you need to say in an interview at Brown is that we will never out-recruit Princeton and Cornell. And you have to be comfortable with that. And you have to be willing to find ways around it. So I love his work ethic. I love his willingness to grind and be up for the challenge. Ultimately, he had a job for life, which is really hard to find in lacrosse. We're currently going through a sea change where lacrosse coaches are going to start to make more. But the expectations around coaching are going to go through the roof with NIL and with portal commitments. So I love that he was up for it. You know, in terms of like this year specifically, I'm preaching both patience and just compete level. Like, I think, you know, I watch more film than most boosters at Brown. And ultimately, like, the Ivy's very competitive. We have a challenging out-of-conference schedule. Like, what I want to see is like attack development. I want to see structure on the back end. I want to see like an identity be formed. But you know, ultimately, there's going to be a regression to the mean. We were not as bad as our record last year. I think if you asked John Tillman, he would tell you that. If you asked Matt Madelon, he would tell you that. Like, ultimately, teams as quote unquote bad as us in terms of RPI don't like beat Princeton with 2 weeks left in the regular season and then having a ton to play for. And just as like a player shout out, Charlie Cave is the best defenseman that nobody's ever heard of. Like, he's legit good. I think being a unanimous first team all Ivy selection when your team is quite bad is very hard to do. And if Aiden can just shoot a little bit better and we get downhill with Corsi and some of those athletes in the midfield, Spencer Hughes, et cetera, you know, I think we're going to scrap. I think we're going to scrap, and I'm excited for it. But, you know, ultimately, I think really, really highly, obviously, of the lefty at Cornell. And I think, you know, with my personal relationship with Kerwin, I feel very strongly that the Ivy League pound for pound has as good of a coaching setup. Like, if you took away the schools and you just took the Ivy League coaches and you gave them the ACC programs or the Big Ten programs, like, I think pound for pound, our coaching DNA is as good as any in the country right now. So it's going to be highly competitive, but really excited to get going. And everybody knows that I'll be there week one. So ready to roll.
All right. So Terry, is it well known that Larkin's going to be writing a column weekly?
Oh, yeah, no. So you can take that one, though.
Okay, Larkin, breaking news. Larkin Kemp is going to be writing a weekly column for Inside Lacrosse. I personally have not been this excited about content since we started the tailgate and since Kevin Brown wrote a fantastic piece about a Queens player being a NASCAR driver. That was really, really cool. But what I'm curious about, Larkin, because you got to self-reflect when you get into the content game. I always lean towards putting too much emphasis on bigger bodies. An Eric Dobson, a Brendan O'Neill, a CJ Kirst. I tend to sway more to that and think that they have a bigger impact on the game than they might. And try to mitigate that by appreciating the Jake Taylor inside finishes, the Pat Kavanaugh assists, the future Chris Kavanaugh assists. But my mind always goes towards, oh, you just need a big body like Dobson to stretch the defense and make everything going. Where are your biases, and where do you plan to kind of address that with a counterweight?
That's a good question. In terms of content creation, well, you know, the origin of me agreeing to do it, first of all, is that I will be biased. This is a Brown propaganda machine, you know, where this is fake news media, basically. But no, I think I'm excited. Like, as an example, coming to graduate school, I don't know if you guys know this, I now help out with the Stanford Lady Cardinal in a non-official role, but I've actually fallen in love as I've gotten older with, like, parts of the game that I never used to think about. So I hope to bring some shine to players, games, conferences, and also just, like, trends, tailwinds that perhaps aren't at the top of mind. So I'm going to look at it more of kind of a, hey, what am I thinking about this week? Like, as an example, I think women should put on some form of shell helmet so that shooting space is not as big of a problem to officiate as imaginable. All the girls hate me.
I think you'll get a lot of people agreeing with you on that.
But so, you know, but I'm just excited, man. I look at content, like what Terry does is a huge part of, if we want the game to get where we hope it does, you know, we need impressions, eyeballs, engagement, and growth. So it's a huge piece of the flywheel, of the Synergy flywheel. And because I have the capacity, I'm not working, I'm happy to get back into it. It's going to be great.
You never know how long a life your content is going to have. I got sent a screenshot of a text message. Tommy Kehoe is one of your historical antecedents. He worked for IL for like 9 months after winning D3 Player of the Year as the first long stick to ever do so. And he wrote a story about how terrible preseason is that one of his teammates shared with, who is now in the Division I assistant coaching game at a very high level, shared with his team. And you could be a source of inspiration for the Brown Bears 10 years from now, and you wouldn't even know it. With that being said, one of the things I also want to get your opinion on is Mike Daly, Director of Player Development at Maryland. And there are two sides to this. The first being, obviously, you've already sung Dale's praises, but also it's a novel role. And as the sport continues to evolve and develop, which, you know, is kind of a pun, but not really intended, that type of role strikes me as being very important. So what do you know about that? And then if you can kind of back into what it means about how you think about Maryland, given, you know, they're the defending runners up and they're going to look a lot different in 25 than they did in 24, especially without Luke Wehrman.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating question. I think the concept of player development for the bottom half, so, you know, as you get into the season, right, it's the job of John Tillman to focus on, let's call it the 25 men in the two deep, and to be extremely granular in getting those players prepared to play and to outperform. So I think the concept, you know, as the riches in the roster, especially for schools that can afford to pay in, with NIL, you're going to have some really high quality depth. And how do you keep those players both engaged and linearly trending, you know, getting better every day? So I think, you know, to speak for Mike, I don't mean to speak for Mike, but I think he's extremely excited to get back to basics and fundamentals. Like, you ultimately fall in love with this game to take a midfielder who doesn't play as a freshman and make him a first-team All-American as a senior. That is like the origin of all people who do this for a living. Like, they love that stuff. I think getting back to basics and building relationships and doing all of the things that he does so well. You know, I tell this to everyone who asks, but the secret sauce, the Kool-Aid of Mike's culture is really his like personal relationship development. So he's a great, person specifically for this role. And I think doing it under the tutelage of Tillman, where he can lean back into, you know, running a postmortem on what went wrong, what went right at Brown, and getting back to on a personal level for him as he looks to potentially take another chair someday. You know, how can he, I kind of think of it as like when Nick Saban hires, you know, the graveyard of fired coaches in college football, or did for that like analyst role, and they both can learn from each other. So I'm excited for him. And I think that that's as good of a coaching staff as you have in the country. It's very rare that you can plug in that type of talent in the kind of volunteer role, right? I think so highly of Jesse B and Phipsy. So, you know, what you can basically guarantee with Maryland this year is they're going to get a lot out of that room. Do they have enough to get over the top when you think about Notre Dame's talent level? Who knows? But ultimately, just to spin it full circle, and I know people think I'm biased, like, Brown is an extremely difficult job. If you look at Mike Daly's track record at Tufts and then at Brown, especially if you index it for he just had a little bit of bad luck that we didn't recruit a ball carrier post-Dylan, like, his track record's pretty damn good. Like, he deserves a Division I opening, and he'll get one.
And listen, guys, let's not forget about Idaho. That's, you know, Larkin, maybe we have to do a little segment where, because I'm the assistant defensive coordinator for Bishop Kelly, you're working with the Lady Cards. Still sticking around the coaching game. And I guess, where do you see the next, like, hey, if it's Brown, and if I'm in Brown's coaching position, I'm going and getting a little bit more scrappy, you know, kind of talking about the difficulties that you've talked about next. We got a good pipeline here. Oscar Sisson, I mean, kid's a stud. Easton Blanchard, kid's a stud. Names that you're going to be hearing a couple years down the pipeline. But as you look to the struggles that you've kind of entailed, say you're sitting in the chair, kind of what's your strategy to combat that? Do you go and get scrappy and kind of into these other areas where, hey, this kid might suck as a freshman, but come junior year when we coach him up, we got a freak athlete who can go, and we're just going to try and make him stay and buy in and love the program. And I do have one quick follow-up question after that.
So I think, you know, when you're sitting down July 1 as a coaching staff and you think about all the different tailwinds in the industry, right, you kind of need to get back to first principles. Like, ultimately, we're now in a salary cap business, which implies, let's think about baseball. Like, if us three run the Pittsburgh Pirates, like, we cannot beat Steve Cohen or the Dodgers in their own game. Like, we have to now come up with a different style, a different identity. Are we gonna recruit only zone defensemen? Are we gonna become like knockdown heavy, not man up, because we can't play man with Maryland and Notre Dame? We can't play now. We definitely can't play in a decade where every single player is making $100,000, right? So it's, I think the talent gap is gonna grow. So the coaches from the bottom half of the table who are going to elevate are ones who I think create structure around being different and being hard to scheme for. So picture Navy football. Like, Navy football gets so much out of that roster consistently because they ran the wing T or whatever it was for 20 years. So that's kind of where my head goes. And I think it's frustrating for probably all the staffs, just the amount of sea change and that we haven't kind of settled into the new steady state yet. So they're trying to work through that in real time. Ivy being the perfect example, like pretending not to want to play ball and not being allowed to be in the payment suit, whatever it is. But it's a tough time to be a coach, man. There's a change coming.
And then my quick and last follow-up was, as it stands today, not looking even 3, 5, 10 years into the future, I would argue that the value of the degree is higher than the NIL money that you'd be able to secure for 99% of college lacrosse. I haven't looked into what the top players are making NIL-wise, but as we look at where the future of lacrosse is headed, I think we're still a little bit of ways away from, oh, I'm signing for this program because they threw a bag at me. What's your take on the ecosystem of the value of this particular degree will pay off more than a lesser degree, which will, you know, set me up for life versus set me up for 4 years potentially?
Wait, hold on. I just want to make sure that this is a question from a guy who went to Notre Dame to a guy who went to Brown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So just, all right, very, very clearly objective.
I wouldn't have gone to Brown for NIL money knowing how much more valuable a Notre Dame degree is over Brown, you know?
Correct. By the way, probably fair.
no, probably not fair, looking at my income since graduating.
So I think it's somewhat of a two-part question. I mean, I think to jump to the thesis, it's going to become a marketplace. Does lacrosse over-index into very smart people with smart parents who do value traditional education? Sure. Will those same people realize that if you pick up 55 ground balls as a freshman, you can literally just like walk into the coach's office and use that leverage to say, hey, you know, yeah, my dad does fairly well, but this is no longer need blind. Like, I had a really good year. This is my market value. You know, you have to, you know, I'm now Boris and Pete Alonso. You have to pay 85 cents on that dollar, or Larkin Kemp is leaving Brown in 2015. So ultimately, like, I do not think lacrosse is an outlier, Nick, from the broader, like, basically sea change that has occurred, where high-quality pieces of the roster, specifically underclassmen, there is no reason not to at least test the waters come June, July, August, or claim to consider test the waters to not have your education paid for. Why would you not do that? Like, ultimately, go ahead, Terry.
I think Largan, one of the things that I appreciate the most about your approach is that you're planning for a potential outcome that consensus is the likeliest outcome. But, you know, as this entire conversation has unfolded, you know, I have preached restraint from the standpoint of it comes from like a kind of inherent point of view that is like very skeptical of a lot of the things coming to fruition the way in which they do, because they're very contradictory to a lot of the interests of stakeholders involved. And so just to make that clearer, so this stems from the proposed House settlement. I mean, the NIL situation does not, but a lot of the knock-on effects do. Specifically, whether it be a roster cap or the ability for schools to pay players themselves. And my contention is kind of two or threefold. So the first is, like, this proposed settlement is only for the members of four conferences, which means that there are 27 or 28 Division I conferences that will decide for themselves whether or not, and their members will decide for themselves whether or not they're going to be party to the principles or the rules that are laid out in this settlement. The second thing is that it assumes that the proposed settlement is actually going to be accepted and you know, put into place as it has been proposed, and there's already been a lot of movement around whether or not that's likely to happen. And then the third is how long it's going to withstand subsequent legal challenge, right? And so specifically when it comes to roster caps, like, there are already so much organization around challenging that, and I think that they're going to be successful because the principle of the roster cap, which is collusion, is exactly the principle that has gotten the NCAA into this situation as it currently is. Now, with all that being said, there is also very little dispute that the combination of the aid, right, grant and aid, it being need-based, academic, or merit-based, in conjunction with other types of cash payments, whether they come from the school itself, the existing infrastructure of NIL, meaning collectives, which are, you know, going to, it sounds like, be phased out for a replacement of market value deals, right? Like, that is going to continue to manifest and grow. Now, it's going to do so differently, both at different institutions and within different sports. The Ivy League is a very important consideration because, relative to other sports, it is very clearly a top three conference in lacrosse where its members compete for national championships. And the thing that changes is exactly what Nick asked, which is the balance of the value of the degree and the things that I otherwise might sacrifice on a cash basis relative to what I can get from a cash basis. And this is a decision that, to this point, we've seen maybe be the determining factor between somebody going to Ohio State versus somebody going to, I don't know, like maybe North Carolina. Like, I'm not even really sure. But with that being said, the strongest effect that it has on the Ivy League is basically they've been able to recruit from two bands of socioeconomic background. One band being high net worth, where the cost of tuition is not significant to their ability to attend. And then the other band being low income, to the point where the need-based aid is going to accommodate their ability to attend. But there is a middle band that where effectively affording the ability to attend is not feasible, but also their family makes too much such that, like, they don't qualify for that need-based aid. That is where the NIL opportunity rests most substantially. And what it means going forward is an open question, but what it, as far as I have learned, it is meant to resolve is giving those seven programs the ability to recruit guys who to this point they just haven't been able to recruit. Not because they couldn't handle it academically, either getting in or being successful once they're in, but because the finances didn't work out. And so if the NIL opportunity allows them to, you use the example of pay in total, but even just pay a considerable amount of the very high cost of attendance, then it opens up a new raft of recruits that just haven't existed for the last however long.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And I agree specifically on the middle band point. And I do think, Nick, to spin it more positive, there is a scenario in which it could act as a change agent to just get a few new schools into the mix in the direction of the Blue Bloods, using Oregon football as the primary example, right? Oregon had no tradition, no history. A really rich guy decided to change that. Well, lacrosse has a lot of very successful guys who went to very bizarre schools. And when you think of the cost of the dollar, like the cost of capital, it's really not that much money for these guys to overnight go find a John Grant Jr., go find a Wes Berg, and all of a sudden a Patriot League team looks a whole lot like the Colorado Mammoth. So while I'm very sad about where we're headed, just based on the nature, I think, of what it'll mean both for the value of the degree and for regional rivalries, probably is the easiest way to frame it. And I think roster caps, for people who like haven't done the, you know, aren't as in the weeds as Terry is, if you go look at what college football is going to have to do this spring, getting from 135 football players down to 105, it's like so sad. And in many ways, the death of like college athletics. So it's a huge bummer, but yeah.
Well, using your the two players that you use, it seems like we just need to keep an eye on the exchange rate between American and Canadian dollars. American dollar becomes powerful, all of a sudden we're going to get 2015 DU again.
But what if it's the 51st state? Then there is no exchange rate.
Larkin, outlook on the recruiting prospects from Greenland, the 52nd state.
Number one rule when you go to graduate school is you realize don't comment on politics. I do not wave a flag or a color. I support, you know, free speech.
You have an American flag on your sleeve right there. Yeah. All right, that is a fantastic note to end on. Larkin, thank you for joining. Nick, looking forward to a great season ahead. You are happy and thriving, as is this podcast. Let's go, boys. Next time we're going to have real games to talk about.
Hey, and this is nice because normally I just log off with love you, Terry. But Larkin, love you and miss you, bro. We got to get back together. Terry, love you. And Dom was asking me when we're going to see each other again. So
take it to Boise. Getting booked today. Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.